The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Right now with me in studio are Professor Freddie Wood and Patrick Barry. So Professor Wood is a surgeon who is central to the development of Ireland's heart transplant programme. And the first heart transplant happened, if you can believe it, 40 years ago in the Mater Hospital. Patrick was a patient that Freddie transplanted in 1995 when you were just 11 years old. Is that right, Patrick?
It's 11, yeah. 1993,
yeah. Oh, God. You should have taken the 95. Not 2 years off you there.
I know. Yeah, I was only 11. Never sick before in my life. Just caught a virus. Within a few months, told needed the transplant. It's called cardiomyopathy dilated. Freddie is well aware of it, I'm sure. It's a virus, you know. Common amongst transplant patients. Life turned upside down in a couple of months. Healthy all the way up. Told I needed a new heart. Was in Our Lady's waiting on a heart. Heart came in a week before Christmas. 11 years of age. I suppose it would have been over my head. It's more my mother and father and stuff like that, you know. I've come from a big family. Everyone was worrying and shipped over to the Mater that night. Freddie was the man at the time. Freddie and Morris Nelligan were both doing it. It was Freddie on that night. The old part of the Mater, I was only 11. You're walking in, the big ceilings, the whole lot. And all a bit daunting, but it was all very positive. As soon as I got over there, the staff, the anaesthetist, the nurses, Freddie. It was just, they made me feel at home as much as you can going in for a heart transplant, you know.
And this was, you know, 8 years after the first heart transplant was carried out, Freddie. So maybe talk to us a little bit about that, about the lead up to it, about how big an event it was at the time.
For Paddy?
Well, not for Paddy, for the first heart transplant, well, kind of back 40 years ago, so 8 years before Paddy.
In 1985... there were four surgeons in the unit. The unit had been formed by Professor Owen O'Malley and Mr. Keith Shaw in 1971. And then Morris was appointed at that stage as the first trained cardiac surgeon. I was appointed in 1983. And in 1984, we had got up to do it. There were four cases, open heart cases a day. That was 20 a week. And we often worked Saturdays and Sundays. And we were on target to do over 1,000 cases that year, which have made us one of the top three biggest units in Britain or Ireland. And Morris always had the ideal, and so had I, that that every type of surgical operation for heart disease would be available in Ireland. So it just so happened that one of the cardiologists in Vincent's, Dr. Brian Moore, had a patient in late spring 84 with cardiomyopathy, like what Paddy had. Mm. And he happened to say to Morris, would we ever consider transplantation? And Morris said it to me. And 2 years previously, Norman Shumway, who was really the father and innovator behind all of heart transplantation, even though Christian Barnard did the first one, Norman Shumway in Stanford, California, had shown how to do it and worked out the rejection regime and everything else. And it was his research fellow had shown Barnard how to do it. But anyway, Norman Shumway, 2 years before 1985, had produced a paper and results using the anti-rejection drug cyclosporine, which is common today. And it radically had changed how heart transplant patients could be managed and how they survived. They only needed, at that stage, they only needed 3 weeks in hospital and an isolation room. Prior to the introduction of this drug, they were in hospital 3 to 6 months in isolation. So we looked at it and we talked to our immediate colleagues, anaesthetics, and John Magner and Roisin McSullivan came on board. And then we discovered that one of our pathologists was used to doing biopsies when he was in Boston on the heart, and our microbiologist had looked after kidney transplants. Mm. So suddenly we had a core of a team, and that started it all.
What was the challenge, the biggest challenge you faced in terms of carrying this out?
At that stage, the biggest challenge was we'd a separate cardiac intensive care, but we'd no isolation rooms. So Morris went on a fundraising campaign, and he was remarkably adept at fundraising. And in late November 84, Richard Allen, you probably wouldn't remember them, they were haberdashers on Grafton Street, they agreed to do a fashion show a black tie fashion show in the Burlington, and over 2,000 people or more attended it. And that started fundraising, and it gave us the money to build these two isolation rooms, to send nurses to Harefield, both from theatre and intensive care, to convince them that they had the ability to do it, and also to send the scientists from the laboratory away to learn how to assay the cyclosporin drug, because that was crucial to us managing rejection afterwards. So that was all in place by late spring 85. Brian Moore in Vincent's, and Conor McCarthy, the cardiologist in the matter, both referred us two patients, one each, two patients, and we were ready to go from June 85. Now, you people probably wouldn't remember, but in that year, there were 6 liver transplants attempted in the city, and only one survived, 5 died. And the Minister of Health at the time, Barry Desmond, and the Department of Health put an embargo on.
Did they all die for the same reason?
Well, they all died within within 24 hours or within a couple of days after transplantation.
Okay.
So there was an absolute embargo on livers. We hadn't formally asked anybody, fortunately. I'm sure the answer would have been no if we had. But there was a degree of tension.
Okay.
And I mean, I remember the day well. The day wasn't like today. It was an Indian summer day. I was certainly excited, and so was Morris. Certainly wasn't nervous in any way.
And from a medical point of view, or from a procedural point of view, and this sounds like a silly question, but the surgery itself, I mean, how complicated or complex was that? Like, is the challenge, because you've mentioned now a few times the anti-rejection drugs, is that where the real challenge was, post-surgery?
Well, no, there was a whole number of challenges. first of all, you have to get a suitable donor that matches body size and so on, with the heart functioning well. You have to preserve it. It's taken for granted these days that you can take an organ out and just hold it for any length of time and plop it into somebody. That isn't the case, certainly not in hearts. It takes about half an hour to 40 minutes to actually harvest the heart where it has no blood. Then you pack it in ice, and that takes another 15 minutes. Then you have to gallop into your transport, whether it's a car, or in this case, our first one happened to be a helicopter. So we had to allow for that time. The flight to Wexford General, flight back was about 45 minutes. So by the time the donor heart got back to the matter, 2 hours had already elapsed, where it was without any nourishment whatsoever.
Yeah.
We then had if we got beyond 3 hours in 1985, then we had a 1 in 4 chance of that heart not working.
Okay.
When we revitalized it.
Okay. So you're racing against the clock.
You're racing against the clock all the time.
And then, assuming then you get the heart there in time under this 3 hour mark, then where's the next challenge?
Well,
then?
The next challenge then is to put it in without twisting anything.
Okay.
Because it's quite strange when you look into somebody's chest and the heart has been taken out and it's empty.
Yes.
And they're being kept alive by the artificial heart lung machine.
Yeah.
And you just see this big empty cavity. So then the heart is held up and you have to ensure that you put it in without twisting anything, that you don't twist the great veins coming back to the heart and you don't twist the two arteries of the heart. The next challenge then is you have to revitalize it, get the patient's blood back into it and get it beating in such a way that it can then take the patient, it'll beat powerfully enough to take the patient off the heart-lung machine.
How do you do that? How do you get it to start beating again?
You mainly get it by revitalizing, letting the patient's blood back into the heart.
And just the reintroduction of the blood often will just get it to beat.
Yes, but just to explain to you, the heart has been out in the open, it's full of air.
Yeah.
So the cavities, one of the real tricks of it is to get all the air out of the cavities, because if any bubbles of air go into the main artery, they'll go down the coronary arteries.
Okay.
And they will further damage the heart, maybe irreparably, and you're done.
How do you get all the air out?
Well, the, there's certain surgical techniques with needles and things that you use. If you have to use it too often, they bleed, because to do all this surgery, you give a drug called heparin so that the patient doesn't coagulate, doesn't form clot at all. So everything, all the holes, stitch holes and all the needle holes, they bleed like mad. So after getting the heart to beat and work, the next thing is to get take them off the heart-lung machine, but get all the bleeding controlled.
Okay.
And then they go back to intensive care. And what happens then is that, well, the new heart is different than yours or mine or Paddy's.
Not mine.
That's exactly like
Paddy's. The electronic system of it works differently. It takes 5 days to 7 days to start working properly.
Okay.
So often you have to take over it working by using a pacemaker to get it to work. But it still doesn't work with the same efficiency as a normal human heart.
Ever?
Well, it eventually does.
Okay.
But not in the first, not in the vital first 5 days to 14 days afterwards.
Okay.
And that's a crucial time.
And how nervous were ye in those crucial days after that first surgery, both for, I guess, for the patient themselves, because that's your immediate concern, you're trying to save this person's life, but also just for, I don't say legacy in the sense of your own legacy, but the importance that maybe was attached, the relevance of this, you know, huge undertaking.
We were never nervous about ourselves.
Mm.
We were excited all the time, but never nervous. Yes, on the morning after the transplant at 7 a.m., when we were back in looking at Eddie Kelly, the patient, we were concerned because his donor heart was not working properly. And what a lot of people don't know is we had him back in theatre by 8:30, hoping to find clot around his heart. Instead, we found that his donor heart wasn't working very well.
Oh, God.
Now, fortunately, we were able to do things that over the next couple of days, things improved. And then he was eventually discharged on day 16 successfully.
Mm.
But so we were, if you like, anxious in relation to getting him to recover well and get his kidneys to work. One of the problems of heart transplantation is the drug cyclosporine, or the one they use now, often used now, tacrolimus, they damage the kidneys quite badly.
Okay.
So you can get kidney failure at the same time. And if that happens, that really complicates things. But Eddie's worked very well. And then 32 days later, we did the second one, Christy O'Hanlon, and we were very fortunate with him. He survived 13 years, and he was such a gem of a patient, and his wife, Bernie. He was a great advocate for transplantation and a great help to all the other transplants that we did.
Poor Patrick has been sitting here listening to all of this. It's fascinating stuff, and so many more questions, but I do want to bring you in, Patrick. So you were 11.
11,
Had you any sense, you mentioned it earlier, it was maybe more your parents felt the weight of it, but had you any sense at age 11 of what was going to happen?
I sort of did. I was a bit of a grown-up 11, you know. I sort of knew. The information wasn't around. There was no internet back then to look stuff up or anything, but I knew about it, so I've always been a positive person, so I was always just thinking about after. You know, I was thinking, I can't wait to get this heart done. I get back to sports, I get back to this, I get back to... You're never thinking, that'll be it, you're going to die.
Was there a slow dawning in the years afterwards about the...
As
the
I got up at all. I suppose
what you gone
I was
through?
11, and then I had a bit of rejection on and off for a couple of years. We balanced the medication, the whole lot. Again, I let my parents worry, I never worried. Teenage years, played football, got into boxing, silly stuff. I was always mad at the soccer and stuff like that, you know. Never really worried. If I look back now, I think, geez, I should have worried. Do you know that way? But I was never a worrier. It's just, I think that's what's helped me along the way. I never really stressed about it. It seems to have worked out for me. Like, I'm 32 years out now, you know.
Mm.
I've kids. I've a girl, Emily. She's 12, and my older one is 15. And I look at Emily, 12 now, and I say, jeez, if she had to go through, you know, with the age I was at, and you just couldn't imagine it, you know?
An appreciation of what your parents
I look
through.
At my parents now and I say, you went to, I know we did, you know, they say it to me, like, you know. But no, Freddie was very good. The whole team was very good. It was a positive experience, even though it's the worst time of your life. The matter made it. It's such a positive experience. I suppose because I was so young, it was like, yeah. I was walking around the matter and I was 11 and the nearest person I'd see is a 60-year-old, you know? And I was in there for, I don't know how long, but I was in for a good while because I was so young and everybody rallied around me and it was, because I couldn't thank them enough, you know?
I'm so happy to hear Freddie sounding so great, says one of our listeners. He performed heart surgery on me in 1980 and then performed heart surgery. No, sorry, Professor O'Malley performed heart surgery on me in 1980 and then Freddie performed heart surgery on my son in 1999 and 2005. All remarkable people. Yeah. So there you go. Lots and lots of messages along those lines coming in. Were you celebrities for a time afterwards, Freddie?
Oh, yes, undoubtedly.
Still are, says you. Look at you.
Deservedly so.
There were all kinds of things happened. I think one of the best things...
If only they had Dancing with the Stars and things back then. Could you imagine?
Morris might have done it. I don't know. But one of the great things with Paddy was, because I worked in the children's hospital as well, so after a difficult day in the children's hospital, I'd wander up to his bedroom and sit on the bed and just chat to him. This is before the transplant surgery, not just to comfort him, but it de-stressed me from all the problems down in theatre. So it worked both ways. It helped me as well. And then it'd go back to ICU and look at the little babies that I'd operated on. One of the nice things that happened was Eamon O'Meary. I don't know if you remember Eamon O'Meary, the investigative reporter from RTE. In 1988, he asked, could he do a thing on transplantation and donors? And so he followed us around for a year. And it just so happened on one weekend, we did one transplant, I think it was on a Saturday, and we did the second transplant on a Sunday. And they're both the two patients he was following for the whole year. And then he spoke to the donor families afterwards. Mm. And he ultimately got a Jacobs Award for that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have access to it, but it was a fabulous piece of work.
Well, if somebody out there can rustle it up, send it our way, we'll share it on our social media platforms. It's great to talk to you, Freddie. Yeah, thanks a million for coming into us. Patrick, thanks a million for coming into us as well. Thanks very much. Professor Freddie Wood and Patrick Barry.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.